because it's so tiny. Had I thought earlier, I would have had it put on there. But it is an international badge, and it stands for prostate cancer. So all men, this is a message for you. If you are approaching 40 or older, this is a message for you. Go and have a talk with your GP, doctor, and talk about prostate cancer. I had prostate cancer 5 years ago, almost to the day, and had surgery. I was fortunate because they caught it early. And so if you're a wife and your husband is approaching 40 or is older than that and hasn't had that conversation with the doctor, encourage him. And the same for your sons and other male relatives. I have to say this because I promised Dr. Singera, you don't know her, but I say to her, every time I stand in front of men, I would tell them about prostate cancer, because she was complaining that men don't talk about prostate cancer. Well, there it is. You've heard it from me. I am Joe Capolio. I come from Zambia in Africa. And on Wednesday, I am going to be 70 years old. So I'm a little older than I look. I've been around the block quite a few times. Okay, and my wife is sat over there somewhere. You will see her later on. For 11 years, I was pastor of a church in London, and we had a lot of people from the Caribbean. That's one continent you didn't mention. It's not quite a continent, but it's an entity on its own. And there was a story circulating that a lady had come from the Caribbean to this country, and she had worked very, very hard and saved a lot of money because she wanted to build a very big house for her family back in her home country. And she arranged with her son, who lived there, to say she'd send the money. Could he supervise this building project? After several years, she decided to go and see. She'd seen pictures, but she wanted to go and see it for herself. And so she got on a plane and landed in this country. And lo and behold, there was a man, not her son, a man with a plaque and her name on it. And so she marched up to him and said, "I'm the person you're looking for." "Ah," she said, "I'm a taxi driver. Let us go." They got into the taxi. They set off. And as they were driving, the driver pulled out a photograph and said to this lady, "Is this you?" And she looked at it and she smiled and she says, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I got this photograph from your son." And then he pulled out a handgun, a pistol. And he said, "This is a pistol which was given to me by your son. And he said to me, 'Get rid of her.'" You look to me like a good person, and I don't have the guts to kill you. If you want to live, I suggest you get back to the airport and go back where you've just come from. And I don't know what I'm going to have to do, because your son, if he finds out I haven't killed you, He will come for me. When I first heard that story, I thought, it can't be true. How can anyone do that to his own mother, who has been working her fingers to the bone to raise all this money so that he could have this fantastic house to live in? And that's the way he treats her. I thought it was one of those apocryphal stories that circulate from time to time. But there were people in that congregation who knew this woman and who could verify the truth of that story. Now, what we are dealing with in the story in the Bible is similar to that story I have just told you, where a child turns his back on his parent and does horrible things and then goes away. And when he returns, what should happen to him? So what we have in Luke chapter 15 that John read for us, this man abused what was a standard institution in that culture. If a man had two sons before he died, he would divide his wealth into three portions. He would take the two portions and give it to the older son, and the other one portion would go to the younger son. Now, this might happen a year before the man dies, or 5 years before the man, it doesn't matter. What the children were not entitled to do was either to take their assets and disappear, or even spend it. And the father wasn't allowed to spend it either. He couldn't start spending their inheritance before he died. They would stay together until the old man died. They would do their duty in burying him. Then they could decide what they wanted to do. So to go to your father and say, "Give me what belongs to me," was saying, "You're hanging around too long. You should be dead. And I want to get on with my life." That's what the young man was saying to his father. And by some grace, which we can't understand, the father actually did what the son asked for. Father should have called the elders to discipline this young man, but he did not. So the young man, we are told, left the country and he went and he disposed of his assets in wild living. He just destroyed all the values that he had been brought up in that one act of disobedience. It was so bad that if the parents had been so minded, the mother and the father would have grabbed hold of him and taken him to the elders of the town or city or village, and according to Deuteronomy chapter 21, they would have executed him by throwing stones on him. What he did was grounds enough for imprisonment, for stoning, and or excommunication from that community. But those things didn't happen to him. He then went off to this far country where he was very famous and had lots of hangers-on because he had money. And he was spending his money as if there was no tomorrow. Carefree life with no provision for the future. And here I suppose one needs to say something to university students setting out on this fantastic life. There are many students who set out like you, and you find freedoms in a strange country, in a strange city, and there are no parents to watch over you, and you have all this freedom. No one is going to say, now sit down and do your homework. No one is going to care even. They'll just say, the lectures are in that place at that time. See you there. If you don't go, nobody will check the register. But there will be an accounting at the end of the year. Your sponsors will want a report, not to mention your parents. It's important to think about what will happen in future. Young man's accounting did come because in that country where he was living, there was a famine. And famines, particularly in rural communities in Israel, were quite common. Where I grew up, lived in a village in the northeast of Zambia, and the months between February and March were always very difficult because that was just before the crops ripened. And the food stored up from last year was coming to an end because we lived from year to year. And it was very hard to survive those 2 months. And if there was a drought, then that's just exacerbated the problem, and many people died as a result. So there was a famine. And in a famine, families close ranks. And those who don't belong to the families, they're excluded. I'm so glad Jill and Leeds Transformations have got together to introduce our visitors into homes in our city. This is so important because so often hospitality goes to those to whom it belongs, those who are entitled to it. This is a very important thing to do, to welcome strangers in your home. And enjoy these strangers. They have a wealth of information to give us in our homes. Let them be free to enjoy. But this young man, nobody invited him. He had bought lots of beers for them and things. Nobody invited him. And it says nobody gave him anything. And there was nothing to be had because of the famine. So anyway, he remembers that there is such a thing as work. And so he goes looking for a job, and the only job he could get was looking after pigs. Now, you have to think, this is a good Jewish boy. Well, he was good until he made that fateful decision. And the Jews knew God had said, don't even touch pigs, let alone eat them. There are lots of scriptures in the Old Testament which say, don't touch pigs, don't eat pigs, don't have any associations with pigs. Well, here he is looking after pigs. In that culture, how low can you get? The other thing that we see is it says he longed to eat the food that the pigs were eating. We all have ambitions. And our friends who are starting university, this is part of the fulfillment of those ambitions. They are high ambitions, the sky is the limit. This man's ambitions were to eat the things that the pigs ate. That's how low he'd come. And I think it was when he recognized this that it says he came to his senses. He'd sunk so low he could sink no further. Now we often focus on the one that went away, but the story of the one that stayed at home is very similar. It is possible to be lost at home. Because this young man, the brother, the older brother, outwardly he appeared loyal. He says, I have been slaving for you. In other words, he worked very hard for his father. He was loyal, he was responsible, he was diligent. But inwardly, he was filled with jealousy. He resented his brother for going away. And as he says, he resented his father for not giving him slack so that he could have a party with his friends and perhaps do some of the things that he'd heard his younger brother was doing wherever he was. And we notice that when he came back from the fields where he'd been working, there was a party at home. What's going on? And they said, your brother's come back and your father has taken down the fatted calf, the one they have been breeding specially for a big feast. He's killed it for him. That was it. That was it. And he refused to join in the celebrations. And notice that culturally, what should have happened is his father should have just sent orders, bring him in. And he would have had to come in. But his father went out to see him. That humiliated the father before his peers. You don't do that sort of thing when you're the head of a household. But his father loved both his boys, the one that had gone away and the one that remained, exactly the same. And he was willing to go out, lose face, and say, come on, son, come on in. We're not told that he came in. But let's go back to the one that went away. He came to himself, verse 17. And that is always the first step to conversion and reconciliation. In his case, this was brought about by a crisis. There was hunger, there was failure, and he came to himself and thought, I can't go on like this. I've got to do something about this. We've been celebrating the life of Queen Elizabeth II these past 2 weeks or so, and one of the most poignant moments in her life was when she is seen shaking hands with a gentleman called Martin McGuinness. Now, Martin McGuinness, those of you who are British will know, had been a commander of the guerrilla group, the IRA. And it was almost certain that Martin McGuinness was the one who gave the order to blow up the Queen's uncle's boat in which Lord Mountbatten died. Now, the Queen really should have been resentful to the IRA, resentful to Martin McGuinness, was one of the commanders. She should have had nothing but hatred for him. Certainly should not have extended a hand of friendship to him. That's what one would expect. But that is futile. The cycles of attack and revenge. And the queen, in her faith, her wisdom, had recognized that that didn't work. And so humbly, she went to that meeting. I can't remember whether it was Dublin or not. And she shook his hands and perhaps paved the way for a sustained peace agreement on the island of Ireland. The young man decided to go back, and he made an apology. I have sinned against you, I've sinned against heaven, and he said, I don't deserve to be your son anymore. He recognized just how difficult the thing he had done had been for his father, and was truly sorry, not only because he was hungry, it was that, but because it hurt his father. And he rehearsed his apology, and as he trudged the long way back, he was rehearsing, not really knowing what his father would do. Well, he knew what his father should do. His father should gather the elders. As they saw him, they should confront him. And his father should say, you made your bed, go and lie in it. And the whole community would have sent him away. There was provision in the culture for doing that. That's the way the story should end it. The reason we still read about it is because it didn't end the way it should have ended. We read about the father perhaps hearing songs. I lived in a little village, and I imagine one of the ways in which you heard news was you heard people singing about anything. If there was a visitor who hadn't been for a long time, the first person to encounter that person coming into the village would sing to welcome that person. Or they would sing. If there was a bit of an issue, they would sing songs which indicated this hated person had arrived. And it was likely that the people who first encountered this man started singing, and the father heard, and he just picked up his skirts. Men wore skirts in those days. And he ran through the village. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, King David, who used to wear skirts, he was so full of the joy of the Lord before the Ark of the Covenant that he was dancing. Now, as he danced, he exposed his legs. Because if you have a skirt, you often have to hitch them up in order to dance properly. And his wife saw him, and she despised him, because Middle Eastern men who have self-respect don't expose their legs in public. She despised him. But this father, he ran through the village, and he didn't care what they thought. He just ran in order to go and throw his arms around his son. And some commentators tell us that this wasn't a sentimental, hello son, welcome back. It was a protective cordon, because he would have known that some people might already have decided to strike him, to beat him up. So by throwing his arms around him, he protected him. And so he blurted out, I have sinned against you and against heaven, and so on. And don't treat me as a son, but as a hired servant. He knew from his growing up years that his father had three types of servant. There was the slave. Now, when we think of a slave, we think of somebody who has no rights. But in those days, the slave was the one who controlled the estate. These days, we would call him an estate manager. There was the slave. But then there was also the people who had a permanent job, and they were paid monthly. And then thirdly, there were the casuals who were picked up on a daily basis. They were the hired servants. And the son says, make me like one of those hired servants. I have no right to be a son. I have no right to be a slave. I have no right to be a permanent employee. Just treat me like one of your casuals. But the father says, no way. He put shoes on his feet to show that he was a noble person, a cloak over his shoulders, and a ring on his finger. He was restored to his sonship. And then, of course, there was the party. So I could go on running through these things. But let's wind up and just say this. What the Son stands for is all of us in relation to God. God created us, each one of us, you and me, you and me, and you and me, as we sang earlier. He created us for a loving relationship. But many of us don't even know He exists. And many of us have turned away from God in our hearts, in our minds, in our lifestyles. But He is always there waiting for you to return. The Son used His wealth and freedom to destroy His relationships. We have used our free will to destroy our relationships with God. But that hasn't changed His attitude to us. His love, He is waiting. And so He welcomed him. And the son then was restored. So for you and for me, this is saying a number of things. One, God wants a relationship with you. And if you haven't got that relationship with you, with God, then this is the opportunity. We have Peter Morden here and all the elders in the church. Talk to them. How do I become reconciled to God? The Bible is full of it, and they will be very glad to help you. But also, if you have a child you don't speak to because of what they did, then this is saying you prepare the grounds for reconciliation. It's the Father who prepared the grounds for reconciliation. Martin McGuinness would not have been expected to go to the palace, Buckingham Palace, to apologize, but the Queen went to him and shook his hand. You, as a parent, create the conditions for the return of your son or daughter, whoever it might be. For us as a congregation, this parable is saying to us, God is waiting to welcome the unlovely, the unloving, the unattractive, the criminally negligent, the oppressors, the terrorists, the manipulators, the schemers of our world, is willing to welcome anybody and everybody, but we have to tell them about it. This is sending us out into mission to bring people in. I have no doubts that what Transformation Leeds are doing in befriending international students is part of that mission of saying, God loves you, we love you, and we want you to have a relationship, healthy relationship with God. I think my time is up, Peter, so I'll stop there. Thank you.